If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, 'cause the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that.
Oh my gosh, what a powerful song. Yes, The Men Who Died For Me. Memorial Day, what a show we have planned for you today. And Memorial Day is more than barbecues and mattress sales and car deals. It really is remembering those that gave the last full measure of their devotion so that we can live freely. And so we've got an amazing story today. We'll be talking with Orson Swindle. He's a Vietnam veteran, and in 1966, he was doing combat missions over Vietnam when he was shot down. I met him up at Cooper's Troopers, which is a group of Marines that meets once a month up in Northwest Denver. They actually have 6 Iwo Jima World War II veterans that attend the luncheons as well. And so I was at this luncheon, and this gentleman tapped me on the shoulder and said, I was a Vietnam veteran. I was in the Hanoi Hilton. I was in a Vietnamese POW camp for over 6 years and 4 months. And it is a truly amazing story. And we need to stop and reflect about the blood and treasure that was given for us so that we can think about mattress sales and barbecues and car deals. And so it's so great to talk with Orson Swindle. Orson, welcome.
Thank you very much, Kim.
Well, tell us a little bit about you, Orson.
Well, it's a boring story in a lot of ways. I grew up in Southwest Georgia. I attended a small, small town school. Had about 65 kids in my class, and about 45 of us are still living as we approach 82. I attended Georgia Tech and got a degree there, then was commissioned into the Marine Corps, and about 2 years after being on active duty in the Marine Corps, I applied to go to flight school. Went to flight school, returned to Beaufort, South Carolina, where we have a Marine Corps air station, and began flying the Marine Corps F-8 Crusader, which was a fighter attack aircraft. I was posted with my squadron to Da Nang Air Base in South Vietnam around the 1st of February of 1966, and began flying combat missions during that period of time. I flew between that date, I think the 2nd of February when I flew my first mission, I flew 204 relatively successful missions, and got shot down on the very last mission I was to fly in Vietnam, and spent the next 6 years and 4 months roughly of my life in prison in Hanoi. And with that, I'll stop and leave it up to you to ask questions.
Wow. Okay, 204 successful missions. You're shot down. What went through your mind? What happened when you were shot down? Were you hurt? What happened exactly?
Well, we were flying two aircraft. We were flying a mission, and I was flying a single-seat aircraft to make it perfectly clear, but we were flying an interdiction mission up just north of the demilitarized zone, and those Vietnam veterans and those guys in Cooper's Troopers will certainly remember the DMZ. Just north of the DMZ, I had pulled off a bomb run, and my aircraft was struck by an aircraft fire. The Vietnamese had shot down 2 F-4s just prior to my getting shot down on the same target area. And the aircraft ceased to fly. It lost its hydraulic power, which means it's not going to fly. And I ejected. The aircraft pitched nose down, and I was going at about 400 or 500 knots. And I could not get response from the flight controls, and I was forced to eject, and I was immediately captured by the North Vietnamese in the area, and there's an old adage for fighter pilots says that, you know, never jump out of your airplane over the target you just bombed, which is exactly what I did. Okay. And that began my my long time incarceration in Hanoi. I was well south of Hanoi, and it took about, I think, about 40 days for me to get to North Viet, up to Hanoi, and went through quite a bit of very brutal treatment.
Let's stop right there. When we were talking, as we were kind of preparing for this interview, you mentioned that when you left to go to Vietnam, that your son was 4 years old. Share that story with us.
Well, my son, I had one son when I was shot down, and he had just turned 4 years old when I left South Georgia, where I left him and his mother to spend the 13 months I would be in Vietnam, as planned, at least. And he was had just turned four. And when I returned home and talked to him again, it was March the 4th of 1973. I had missed 11 years of his development from 4 to 11. No, I'm sorry, 7 years from 4 to 11. And I have today my stepson, my wife's son, and his wife had triplet girls, grandchildren for us here about 9 years ago. And I have had the great blessing of being able to experience those years 4 now through 9, and it's been the delight of my life to watch these little girls grow up and bring the happiness they have to us. And I understand you're a new grandmother, and I would congratulate you. It's a heck of an experience.
It really, really is. And, you know, you realize, and I feel somewhat trite to say this, you know, I do the World War II project. I have my other radio show, and I feel that we're in a battle of ideas, of which I'm fully engaged in that. And I think it's a serious time in America. However, I obviously never went through and put my life on the line like you did. And but I think that it's important that we work diligently to pass something good to the next generation. So thank you for that. Let's go back to your story. You're shot down. You've been captured. You said it took 40 days to get up to Hanoi. Do you want to talk at all about those 40 days?
Well, I was immediately after capture, they stripped me down and my shorts, and no, I take that back. I still have my flight suit on, but they took my boots and everything that I had on me, which was somewhat was lethal, but they took that away from me, and they put me in a pit. It was about 4 feet, 5 feet deep, and I was shot down about mid-afternoon. And all during that ensuing night, people from the villages came in. I was in this, it was like a cave, but I had this pit inside this small cave, and they had people walk through there, and they had political operatives there who were just stirring them up to a fairly well. And I spent the night being spit on, urinated on, beaten with sticks, thrown, hit by rocks and stones and so forth. And I was in a state of shock, as you might expect from the experience. And that was my introduction to captivity in North Vietnam. The next day or so, I would be taken out for interrogation. And one of the interrogations was before three looked to be officers, as best I could determine. And it was cold. It was November, and I was in shock to begin with. So the temperature dropped a little bit, and I'm sure it wasn't below 45 degrees, but I was freezing to death, not to mention being a little bit terrified about what was about to happen. But I was taken out into a thatch roof hut where I was interrogated, and I would not answer the questions, and they kept threatening me, and finally they just gave up threatening me, and they took parachute riser cord, which is about the diameter of a small pencil, and they put tourniquets above my elbows on both arms and took the stringer from this noose they put around my arms and pulled it from opposite sides, three guys on either side, until they pinned my forearms up my back. My thumbs were up behind my head. They then put strapping around my shoulders and pulled in opposite directions in a similar manner and dislocated my shoulders. Then they put more parachute cord on my fingers, my thumbs, and then put that over a rafter in this hut, and then hoisted me up off the ground and beat the living hell out of me until I talked. That was an abrupt awakening.
What did you say?
Well, I realized that I was hanging up by my thumbs and in excruciating pain. And, you know, I knew I was there was not a person on the face of the earth that could help me. Mm-hmm. And I was going to have to do something because the pain was maddening. And I told my talk. And they sort of cut me down and loosened up the straps on my arms, where it did some rather severe damage to my arms and shoulders. But they start up by saying, who are you? And they knew who I was. My name was on my flight suit, and my squadron's insignia was on the flight suit. So they weren't very sophisticated in interrogation other than torture. Mm-hmm. Started asking me about my squadron and said, how many pilots are in your squadron? And I said, well, 25. It was, I think, 18. And then they said, who is your squadron commander? And I did a little thinking on my feet here. And I thought of my high school football team and my football coaches. And I designated my head football coach as a squadron commander. His assistant was the executive officer at number two. And then the lineup of our football team that year, I graduated and we had a good team. I named all 11 of us as the pilots, and I told them I couldn't remember the rest. Well, they wrote all this stuff down, and when I came home, to fast forward, my hometown, small town, and my family had been there for several generations, and they had a big welcome home more Sunday and asked me to speak to everybody, and the auditorium was filled with people, 300 people or so. And I looked down, and about 7 or 8 of those 11 guys were right in front of me, and I said, I interrupted my remarks. I said, I want to say one thing to you guys down there, and I named them off. I said, don't you ever go to North Vietnam because they're looking for you.
Oh, Orson, my gosh.
But I learned that telling lies was going to be the best way to cope with the pain and suffering that would come in the weeks and months and years that would follow. And I got real good at it.
Mm-hmm. So you were a prisoner of war for 6 years and 4 months. That is a long time out of somebody's mm-hmm. life. And go ahead.
That's hard to comprehend, but put it in terms of 2,304 days. Mm-hmm. It's staggering. I can't comprehend it anymore myself.
Okay, you said one of the things that got you through was lying. You had to talk, because if you didn't talk, they certainly would torture you.
Right.
But you still got tortured probably, right?
Pardon me?
Did you still get tortured even though you talked?
I'm sorry, I'm not getting interference on my phone.
No problem. Were you tortured even when you talked, or did it make it better?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that would usually break the torture cycle, but sometimes it took a long time. They kept me sitting on a stool in the summer of 1969. I was wired to this stool sitting under a lamp, a hanging lamp up. And they kept me awake by having the guards come by and peer in through the bars at me sitting there. And he had a big, long bamboo or fishing pole, as I would call it, down in South Georgia. And his job was to keep me awake. They kept me awake for 10 straight days. And I went sort of nuts through the sleep deprivation and whatever, and they let me rest for a day, and then the next day they came back and said they were trying to get me to write statements against the war and write letters to Senator Kennedy and all this garbage. And they said, surely now you're right. I said, no, I'm not going to write. So I am told by people who were in prison, my absence from my normal cell, I was out there for 10 days, then there was that 1 or 2 day break, and then they kept me on the stool for 10 more days without sleep, and then I went completely nuts, mm-hmm. hallucinations and everything. They started putting we were not fed very well, but they gave us the bowls of soup, and they started salting the soup, and it was the middle of late summer, hot as 40 hills, and I was dehydrated, and I was hallucinating, and I went sort of nuts, and it scared them. And they backed away from me a little bit and sent me back to my cell. And I did write a statement. They got a statement out of me, which one of our tactics was when we had to write, eventually after all of the abuse and torture, we would botch up everything we wrote so that, I mean, all of us were, I think, except for about three people, were college graduates, and we botched the King's English something fierce so that if anybody saw it, they knew something was wrong here. That's not real. Mm-hmm. But they were just ways of coping, but they would usually let up after the torture and throw us back in the cell. Our cells, by the way, were not like you might think of a jail cell with bars. It was solid cinder block walls and very little circulation. The few windows that might be in the prison cell block were all boarded up, and the heat rash would start covering our body in early April, and it would finally be gone somewhere around the end of November. A pretty miserable existence. I got down to less than 130 pounds, if I remember correctly.
So were you in a cell with others, or was it just you by yourself?
Early on, and this was typical, and what I'm saying is very typical of what vast, vast majority of us experienced. I was solo, as we would say in the vernacular of POWs, and that made it difficult, but we had a means of communicating with each other by many means. We had tap code, we had clandestine mail drops and things like that we would organize. We'd whisper under the doors, the cell doors, but they were solid cells, so we couldn't see anybody. But we would whisper to the guy across the corridor, and some of my best friends, I came to know them by looking at their eyeball on their door for months and months and months. And but we communicated, and that helped us through the ordeal. I would later get several roommates, cellmates, over a period of time. I was moved into one cell about 8 months after I was, about 6 months after I was captured. And I moved in with three men who, all three are gone now. There were Air Force captains, Ron Storrs and George McKnight and Wes Sherman. They were all captured in 1965, a year before me. And they were three of the most remarkable people I've ever known. As I say, they're my heroes, and they saved my life by restoring my own sense of dignity. When I moved in with them, I think I was the last person in that camp to get a cellmate. And I moved in with them, and I immediately told them that through the course of the clandestine communication, I'd learned about how tough they were in resisting and their exploits and what they had been through. And I said, I got to apologize to you. I haven't done very well. They tortured me numerous times, and I had to talk to get out of the bind. And one of the guys who just recently passed away, George McKnight, laughed out loud, and he said, Orson, you're looking at the earnest way of North Vietnam. Man, when they got you in the ropes, you're going to tell them something. It's not a question of that. You just want to be careful what you do tell them. And that's where the lying came in handy. But they were extremely uplifting to me to be in that miserable situation and have them help reassure me that I had done the best I could. And that's all we expected of anybody.
Wow. Hey, Orson Swindle, this is a fascinating story. You're a Vietnam veteran, and you were in the Hanoi Hilton for over 6 years. So let's go to break. Kim Munson with the World War II Project. We're talking about Vietnam today. We'll be right back.
All AmeriChicks sponsors are an exclusive partnership with the AmeriChicks and are not affiliated or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the AmeriChicks with Kim Munson and grow your business, contact Kim at AmeriChicks.com. That's AmeriChicks.com.
Award-winning realtor Karen Levine has 30 years of experience with RE/MAX Alliance. As a director with the National Association of Realtors, Karen Levine works to protect your private property rights. Karen Levine believes in home ownership. Since losing her mother to breast cancer, Karen Levine has helped to organize a local fundraising event called Karen's for the Cure, raising money for breast cancer research. Choose Karen Levine to buy or sell your home because she understands that it's more than just a house. Karen Levine comes highly recommended by the AmeriChicks with Kim Munson, so call award-winning realtor Karen Levine with RE/MAX Alliance today at 303-877-7516. That's 303-877-7516.
Come join the 88 Drive-In for all your favorite blockbuster movies. We're open 7 days a week. Admission is only $9 per person, and children under 12 are free. Friday, May 24th through Thursday, May 30th, features will include Pokemon Detective Pikachu, Aladdin, and The Hustle. And remember our popular Monday through Thursday pizza special. Get one 12-inch pizza served fresh and hot from our oven and two tall, cool 16-ounce sodas, all for only $12. Plus, now you can top it all off with our new sweet, crunchy churros and a steaming cup of hot chocolate. For more information, go to our Facebook page or visit our website at 88drivein.net.
You get more out of life when you go out to a movie.
Insurance Claim Radio, Wednesdays at 1 p.m. during ATX. Ask the experts on KLZ 560.
Hey, welcome back to the AmeriChicks World War II Project with Kim Munson. I have on the line Orson Swindoll. He is a Vietnam veteran. He was a Marine pilot. He was shot down and spent over 6 years in the Hanoi Hilton as a prisoner of war. And so we've gone basically through kind of the first part of when you were a prisoner of war. Let's talk about the middle part now. What was the daily routine once you finally got to a point where you had some roommates?
Well, we lived in groups of one, two, and three, and four, and I say one because I think I talk to myself a lot as you pace back and forth in these small cells, but we were kept in these cells, very low circulation. As I said, heat rash was a horrible experience for all of us, and it happened every year.
And what is that exactly? Orson, what is heat rash exactly?
That's right. People in Colorado don't even know what heat rash is. Yeah. I grew up in Southwest Georgia, and it is a condition caused by insufficient circulation and extraordinary heat. I mean, I would lie down at night on this bunk bed that I was, you know, had to sleep on, and oftentimes that was a concrete pad, and sometimes with leg stocks on the end of it, where if you were being punished, they had you in leg stocks. But in the summertime, under a mosquito net, the perspiration would just be rolling off of you hours after you quit moving. And that heat rash and that constant state of moisture all over you leads to a rash, and it would be literally all over our bodies, and it was just miserable, and it itches like mad. So that's heat rash, and if anybody in the audience grew up in Southwest Georgia, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay, so there obviously you can't do anything.
We lived in these small cells, and our beds were basically concrete pads or a board. Oftentimes, it was simply sleeping on a dirty floor. We were fed twice a day, and it was very insufficient food for, you know, our physical makeup. And I lost an enormous amount of weight, as did everybody. The meal usually consisted of a bowl of we called it sewer grass soup, mm-hmm. and a piece of bread or a bowl of rice. And our plate of rice, and that was it. And that went on well into my stay, about the fifth or sixth year, when things seemed to be changing. They were getting some supplies from the iron block countries, and like Poland and Yugoslavia and places, the communist countries, and they were shipping in cans of lamb, goat I call it, mm-hmm. and it was, they gave us just a small amount. I mean, there's nothing to gain weight on. So it was pretty miserable. And then we would be interrogated once or twice a week. by enlisted people who had been taught to speak English, and our interrogations usually were just English lessons. And then when they caught us communicating, the purges would begin, and that would be a horrible experience of torture, beatings, isolation. We had some that lived 4 years without seeing an American. They would not say they weren't communicating, because they never stopped us from communicating. That was our lifeblood, and we knew we had to stick together, and we did a remarkable job of that. It was not a pleasant existence, to say the least. Every night, and sometimes during the day, they had a radio speaker in our cells. It was away from the window, which was boarded up anyway, but it was propaganda, and we never heard a positive word about our country, of our families. Vast majority of us did not get mail. I did not hear from my wife until about 5.5 years after I'd been shut down, and the letters I got from, I think it was 3 or 4, they were all about 3 years old. And it's a mental challenge to stay ahead of the pain, the sadness, the despair, the malnutrition, things like that. And I think of these kids today in colleges, and you spoke of, we're at a turning point in our country about how we're going to go forward. And I read about these kids who are offended by everything under the sun. They need safe places to stay when they're in college because somebody said they didn't like them or they don't agree with them. And I just scratch my head and say, what in the world has happened? Because mm-hmm. This is not the world I grew up in, certainly not the country I grew up in. And when I think of the sacrifices that have been made on behalf of this generation today, and it's done by generations before them, and dear prices were paid, and mm-hmm. I guess I paid a pretty dear price myself, but mm-hmm. certainly not the ultimate price of losing your life. But I just shake my head and wonder, what in the world can an 82-year-old former fighter pilot in the Marine Corps do? But I'm not giving up.
Well, I'm not giving up either. And I think that is one of the reasons that I do this show, this World War II project, is that we need to make sure that we have the history and we teach the history. In fact, I've talked to some of the World War II guys, and I've talked to parents as well, that they've said that in our history books, in our schools these days, there's only like a paragraph for World War II. And the whole story's not being told. And it's really a disservice. But I'll tell you, Orson, when I am out and about, one of the things, it's shameless branding, but I carry around a rubber chicken handbag because it's a conversation piece. And people say, mm-hmm. oh, my God, because you really don't see very many women carrying around rubber chicken handbags as their purse. But it's a great conversation piece. And then I mention I have a couple of radio shows. And then I explain that I've been interviewing these World War II veterans. And to a person, their eyes light up. And I take great heart in that, because I realize that people are hungry for these stories. Your story is absolutely riveting. So you're in the Hanoi Hilton. You're there for a total of over 6 years. You had left a little 4-year-old at home. Did the people back home know if you were alive or not?
I was listed as missing in action, presumed captured, I'm sorry. Okay. And I was not permitted to write home for over 4 years. And then those letters, if they got home, and a few of them did, got home through anti-war activists from the United States that went to Hanoi to give them strength to resist the Americans. I mean, just total damn traitors. And that's the way our mail would get home. And I almost was reluctant to even write, knowing that that's how the mail got home. I didn't want my family exposed to that. Mm-hmm. But that would not be very productive to do that. So, but it was a miserable time. And you speak of your efforts, and God bless you for doing what you're doing. But we're not only not teaching history, isn't it amazing how effective a very small number of people are being at literally erasing our history? And I read a lot, and I am a student of history, and I know that our history has got many, many things we aren't very proud of. We are a flawed country, but we're the best country that ever existed on the face of the earth. And I know from history that the surest way you repeat history is to forget it. And by erasing history, we are wiping out very significant aspects of the history of this country. And that's not good. You know, I lived in South Georgia, and I know about racism, but we've made incredible strides. And if we erase history, how can we learn from it? You know, and it's the most stupid thing in the world. And I read some statistics here recently with it among kids graduating from school in some of our major cities. 40, 50, 60% of them don't have a functioning use of mathematics. They don't have a good command of our language. It's terrifying to me because I grew up in a little small town. We weren't rich, you know, just everyday middle-class family. And I was communicating with a friend of mine today on email, and we were talking about, we went to high school together, about how we were educated. And I said, good Lord, think of it. I was taught to love books, to love history, to read, to know the language, and it's not being conveyed. And I don't know how we survive that if we don't turn it around. And the blame is going to be on all of us, led by the teachers' unions and people and these progressives that want to change everything, and by the families who aren't paying attention to what is happening to their children in school. It's a tragedy.
Well, we do have to be paying attention. And to that, I'm encouraged, Orson. Another project that I've been working on is a study of the Federalist Papers. I'm working with Dr. Tom Kranowitter and his team over at Speakeasy Ideas. And we actually thought, well, why don't we get some people together? And interestingly enough, we decided that we would do this throughout the complete year. We started in January. And we have room for 74 people. And we're doing this over in Centennial at Water's Edge Winery. And Orson, it is sold out, and the wait list is significant. We're going to start another one.
That is fantastic.
I think people are hungry, and we just have to make sure that, you know, I talk to people, and I say, we have to understand why we believe what we believe. And when you tear down history and ignore history, there is no way to understand, you know, who we are, where we come from, why we exist. And you know, that's one of the reasons I do these radio shows is so that we can talk about these things. And I truly am encouraged. I think that there is a great awakening. And
well, we need to spread that. I always speak to people about we all have spheres of influence. And I may know 100 people. You may know 200. You probably do since you're on the radio. And if we could just get our sphere of influence to get active in telling their sphere of influence about the necessity for us to pay attention to all this, and then those people tell their sphere of influence, we can make a difference. And, you know, and I also tell them that, you know, we by nature are easygoing folks. We don't campaign year-round. We aren't activists. We aren't community organizers. But I'll guarantee you the people that are tearing this country down, they work at it every single day. And any day that we're not working on trying to influence people and get the word out about how great this country is and what its history is and why we are like we are, we're losing. And I'm glad you're encouraged, and I really commend that effort. I'd love to come sit in some night. But it's just a phenomenal challenge for all of us. And, you know, President Reagan, who I happened to work for about 8 years, he once said that our freedom is only about one generation from extinction. And if we don't pass it along, it dies. And it's that simple. And that's been the case of democracies throughout history. And, you know, we're the longest existing democracy, I think, that I'm aware of. And we're 250 years old almost. And the reason it don't exist is because in a democracy, we have these liberties. We have these freedoms. We're not pressuring each other, but then we get lax.
Then someone comes in
with a more vile idea, or a vile idea, I shouldn't say more, and they win and democracy disappear. So we got to keep going.
Well, that's right. And we are. We're a democratic constitutional republic. And the founders worked diligently. They thought, they took a look at history. They said, what worked, what didn't work? They looked at Rome. They looked at Greece. And they said, what works, what didn't work? And so they came up with this whole American idea, which is, I do believe that it's at risk right now. I've said to many people, I think that we are in the third founding of America. There was Washington with the Patriots, and there was Lincoln and the Civil War. And I really think that we are in the third founding of America. And I'm encouraged, but it's a heck of a fight right now, for sure.
It's a constant fight.
It is. But the other thing is we stand on the shoulders of giants. We stand on the blood of the Patriots, and that blood goes through our veins, and it is our time. And I think that our kids, I can't really blame our kids, Orson, because I feel it is my generation that have let them down. And one of these days, they're going to wake up, and they're going to say, you guys lied to us. You know what? I'm talking, you know, in the big thing about, you know, what really matters. You've tried to take away our freedom in the name of, you know, fill in whatever activist thing it is. And our kids are going to look at us and say, you know what? You lied to us. And I tell you, that is not the legacy that I want to pass on to the next generation.
Well, you're exactly right. It's not our kids' fault. I mean, I didn't mean to imply that they were at fault. I'm just saying they are the product of our failure to perpetuate the values and the traditions, the heritage of our country and the history of it. In fact, so many under the influence of people who really don't seem to like this country are undermining all of that, and they're getting away with it. And it's up to parents, our generation, to say no to this. Our triplet daughters, granddaughters, go to a charter school, and it is just absolutely superb. They are learning our history. They're learning science. They're learning things at an age of nine that I don't think I learned until I got in high school. I hate to say that because I was pretty well educated, but I am so impressed by what they're getting, but every school is not like that. And that's our fault.
And that
we've let that happen.
We have let that happen, and so we've given up a lot of ground, but we need to hold the line, and then we need to go on the offense on that. We're going to go to break here in just a minute, Orson. We ended up talking about today, which is so important. As you mentioned, Reagan said that freedom is no more than one generation away from losing it, and that's why we have to fight for it. And to be speaking with you, a Vietnam veteran who spent over six years as a POW, you give a perspective that we need to stand up and listen to. So this is Kim Munson with the AmeriChicks. We're talking with Orson Swindle, and we will be right back.
Dan Predovich and his team at Predovich & Company help your business plan ahead financially. The AmeriChicks with Kim Munson highly recommends Predovich & Company as your financial business consultant. Predovich & Company will take care of your tax preparation, bookkeeping, and business advisory services. Dan Predovich and his team want to learn the unique needs of your business through real, honest dialogue. Because of their advanced technological capabilities, Predovich and Company can help clients anywhere in the United States. Call 303-791-3000 to start preparing now for next year's tax season. Organize your business finances with Predovich and Company. Call 303-791-3000 today.
Don't miss Vino and Veritas, Wine and Truth, A Study of the Federalist Papers. Join Kim Munson with the AmeriChicks at Water's Edge Winery in Centennial or Colorado Cork and Keg in Castle Rock. And coming soon, Vino and Veritas in Northern Colorado. Know why you believe what you believe and be able to have conversations with friends, family, and colleagues. Kim Munson with the AmeriChicks would like to thank qualified listeners, Veterans Listening to Veterans, brought to you by Dan Brook and Cheryl Tootin in Centennial,
In Castle Rock, Kim would like to thank Colorado Custom Services, promotional products, embroidery, engraving, and more. Thank you for sponsoring this fascinating study of the U.S. Constitution. Sign up today at AmeriChicks.com.
Welcome back to the AmeriChicks World War II Project. I'm Kim Munson. Be sure and check out my website, AmeriChicks.com, and I am the AmeriChicks on Facebook and Twitter as well. I'd appreciate it if you like me, follow me. And talking today to Orson Swindle, as you know, this show precipitated out of a trip that I took with a team from the Denver Police Activities League in 2016, where we accompanied four D-Day veterans back to Normandy. And standing on the beaches behind these guys, listening to them talk about D-Day, we came back, we realized we have to share these stories. So I've had the great honor to interview over 100 World War II veterans. We've been adding in some of the Korean War vets. The Korean War is referred to as the Forgotten War. And I've been wanting to add in Vietnam veterans as well. And so I was up at Cooper's Troopers, which is a group of Marines that meet up north, and happened to meet Orson Swindle. And as I was standing there, kind of listening to your story, starting to put two and two together, when the other Vietnam veteran came up with tears in his eyes, I'm kind of looking at, I'm like, these are really tough, courageous men that have been through something pretty tough. And so just so pleased and honored to get to interview you, Orson.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, to say the least. And it was a great place for us to meet with troopers, Cooper's Troopers, as we like to call ourselves. And the program, of course, as you knew and others did, and there were six survivors of the Iwo Jima invasion of World War II. All of them were in their 90s. I think the youngest may have been 92 or 93. And they were just a remarkable small group of men. And there are not many of them still alive. Mm-hmm. My father made the landing on Iwo Jima in February of 1945 and survived it. And it's a story that needs to be echoed constantly. Our kids need to hear about it. They need to learn about it more than hear about it. They need to know what price has been paid for this great country. And your efforts certainly help in that. And all of us, everybody, every family ought to tell these stories over and over and over. That just caused me to think about, I have a very dear friend who's Samoan, and there's a tradition in the Samoan culture that all the children have to be educated in the history of their family, and then the grandchildren have to be educated in it, and then on and on and on. They perpetuate their tradition, their history, their culture, and we don't do that. We're too busy with iPhones and sports events and things of this nature. Too many distractions, but history is such a wonderful pleasure. I mean, it is just, I watch old movies. I am just fascinated by history. I want to know what's the story behind that story, and I read all the time, and we just need to get back to that, so that if the public schools aren't going to educate our kids properly, we can at least help educate our kids by enticing them to read. These stories are wonderful stories, and they're true.
Well, my dad always said, you know, each of us has 24 hours in a day, and we decide what we're going to do with that. And so we're equal in the amount of time that we have each day. But then we make choices, yep, which give us unequal outcomes. But we need to be responsible for those choices. And I've always been a proponent of reading. But I am changing that because there's so much junk out there now. We need to read great books. We need to think great thoughts. Those are the places that we need to go. And that was what education really was for. But we're going to have another conversation on all this. We're in our last segment here. And Orson Swindle, you were in the Hanoi Hilton, which was a POW camp back in the Vietnam War. You were there for over 6 years. And so let's get through. I take it that maybe that middle part, it was the days were, they were pretty tough. And, you know, you had meager food, you lost a lot of weight, you had beatings. I mean, there was there much different in that interim period there between when you were captured and then near you, when you started to see maybe a change of what was happening? You know, I think you mentioned maybe in the fifth year. So is that pretty much every day? That's kind of what it was like for about 5 years?
It's an interesting question. And we who flew fighter aircraft, you know, they go very fast and we do crazy things with them and we dive at the ground and, you know, go up high and all that stuff. And they said, what's flying like? What's flying a jet fighter like? I said, well, to a great extent, it's hours and hours on boredom, occasionally interrupted with a few moments of stark terror. And that's sort of the way being a POW was. I mean, we just sat there, and they, you know, one of the things that troubled me so much as day after day went by, and it went on for months and then years, was this idea that all of this time I'm unable to read anything. I hear no truth to communicate with anyone, to share ideas or thoughts or memories is almost impossible because we were tortured and we were caught communicating. So, and people just don't understand what we have. And so it was very difficult as to the question of did the latter phase change? The biggest thing, and I think most of my fellow POWs would probably agree with this, the most dramatic change that we saw was after Ho Chi Minh died, if I remember correctly, on September the 19th of 1969. That caused things to change. And then they started. The torturing was brutal up to that point in time. Then it started to change. That summer I mentioned, which I sat on the stool, Ho Chi Minh died shortly after I finally gave up. And a friend of mine was out. They were doing the same thing to him, had me sitting on a stool. And the word came that Ho Chi Minh had died, and he was immediately taken back to his cell. So the harsh torture began to subside with Ho Chi Minh's death. Then the Sante raid, which occurred in November the 20th of 1970, when special forces came into the camp where I was, where they kept me sitting on the stool for so long, Sante, we had just been moved about 30 or 40 days before that, if I remember correctly, a couple of months. And that scared the living daylights out of them. They had we been there, we would have been home. It would have been about 55 of us. I mean, just, it's a remarkable story in itself. Talk about heroes. Those are heroes. And we were all moved into the Hanoi Hilton, as we call it, which is the big camp, a big prison, Wallow, which had been around since the days of French colonials. And we were there, and we got very sophisticated with our communication, and things changed dramatically with that because they could no longer isolate us and keep us in small groups. We were all in the same place at the same time. We were in different cell blocks with about 40 or 50 in each one, but we developed communications, and they never stopped us from communicating. And then, of course, when the bombing of Hanoi occurred in 1972, December, that really changed things. In fact, that taught, I mean, we could have won that war. My God, there were so many mistakes made in that war. And, you know, in the final analysis, maybe we did win by staying there as long as we did. Vietnam today is a communist government, but it is so capitalistic that you're watching the news of President Trump's visit to Hanoi. It's like a modern city. And so maybe in the final analysis, we did win. But the treatment after the bombing of Hanoi, it was amazing. And we had no way of knowing what was going on other than there was this peace accord, peace talks, which had been going on for 3 years, by the way. And then they call us out in late January of 73 and read to us the final accords of the Paris peace talks. And we had long since said that under no circumstances do we show any elation over news of our release, however they want to do it. But we had seen pictures, movies, film of the French and their surrender, a big propaganda movie. And the French were jumping up and down, and we said, don't ever do that. To every guy that we could get in touch with, don't you ever do that. Do not show elation. So they called us out, read the peace accords to us. We stood there very stoically, and the senior officer of the Vietnamese said, did you understand what we just said? And we said, oh, yeah, we understand. Maybe we'd be dismissed. And he said, go back to yourselves. So it was just drop-jawed. He didn't know what to say. We all went, and this happened one time after another. And we fought them every step of the way, and in the final analysis, we won, at least the Battle of Hanoi.
You know, it's interesting that you would say that. I need to learn a lot more about this. I recently did on my other show, I had a former Army special something, I apologize on that, but Frank Hawkins, and he had
special
done
Special Forces, I think.
Something and he, like that. Yeah, he's done a couple of pieces in the American Thinker, and one of them was the 10 most destructive Americans. And one of the guys on there was Walter Cronkite. And, you know, Walter Cronkite was a newscaster that Frank Hawkins' premise is that Walter Cronkite got the reporting wrong. And many, many years later, he acknowledged that. But there was tremendous damage that was done. He'd be on every day during the evening news talking about the war. And Frank Hawkins said that Walter Cronkite had gotten it wrong.
Uncle Walter. Mm-hmm. He was a beloved person. A little interesting side note, when I came home, after I came home, I was working in the Reagan administration. I was with President Reagan for 8 years in his administration. And I was called by Walter Cronkite, one of his producers. Walter Cronkite, as you might recall, in about 81, went to Hanoi. And he wanted a POW to go with him. And I said, please tell Mr. Cronkite that I had such respect for him for so long. And it's because of that respect, I will just merely say thank you for the invitation. I will not go, because he failed us immensely with his courage. Mm-hmm. And he was duped. And so many were duped. And mm-hmm. some of them, I think, even had the intention to be duped. But we won in the long run.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, well, Orson, let's go to, you said that they brought you out, and they said that the Paris Peace Accords, that there's been an agreement on that. Talk about the end of your captivity, coming home. Tell us how that was. We've got about 6 minutes.
Okay. We had been blind. Every time we were moved, and we moved often around Hanoi, we were blindfolded and handcuffed, and all this routine is always at night. Well, when they brought the international team in, and they talked to us about we were about to be released and blah, 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 and they gave us some clothes. And they drove us in a bus. This is in increments. So it's first with the middle of February, then I was with a march, another group around 21 March, and then I think it was one last very small group. And it was all by date of shoot down, or whether you injured came out first, of course, but the rest of us came out in the order of being shot down. And we drove through Hanoi, which had just been obliterated by the B-52s, and we enjoyed the hell out of that ride, I might add. And we got to the airport, and I'll probably get choked up when I tell this story because it's really emotional, but we were driven out in a bus. There were about 20 of us on this small bus, and we were taken back around the hangar, an old rusted out hangar, and we were the turnover process was there, and there was a big square, maybe 20 yards by 20 yards square, and sitting at, and was surrounded by Vietnamese and media people. And they were filming everything. And the receiving officer from the United States, in my case, was a Brigadier General Ogun, as I recall his name. And but my group were waiting for our turn to be released to this general. And we were sitting there, and there were no planes there at the time when my group got there. And we were sitting in this bus, and I looked out the window, And off in the distance was a smoke trail from the fuel burning of a big C-141 transport plane. They became known as the Hanoi Taxi. And it approached us, and I kept staring at it, and all of us were looking at it and staring and staring. And then because of the horizon and the buildings in place, it landed. And as it taxied close to us, it finally came into view. And the first thing we saw was a tail. And there was a big red, white, and blue American flag painted on its tail. Wow. And that was the most emotional thing I think I've ever experienced in my life. Wow. And to realize that this was not some propaganda charade we were going through. This is real. And we were escorted individually out. They announced us. We went up, saluted the general, and then we were introduced to an escort officer, who was an Air Force officer in my case. Walked out the C-141 to get on, walk the back ramp and get on that airplane. And we all got on the airplane. The pilots closed that ramp, and we started taxiing. And all of us were just sitting there almost in disbelief. It had been so long. And we took off, and as soon as we lifted up and he raised the landing gear, which you really know because it's a lot of noise, we cheered. And then he turned to the east, and as we crossed the beach, a term that we use in flying combat, he said, "Gentlemen, feet wet." In other words, we were out over the water. We're going home. It was really emotional.
Wow.
I could talk for hours about this. Mm-hmm. And seeing my wife and my son was an emotional experience that I really would break up. I'll meet you someplace with your husband and we'll have a glass of wine. I'll tell you that, and then I can cry.
I tell you, I've got tears in my eyes on this, Orson. So, big radio show hosts aren't supposed to cry, right? So that's quite. The story. So, Orson, we've got just about a minute and a half, and we've talked a little bit about it, but what is your message to the young people in America today?
Well, learn about our country. You're getting a lot of false information. This is a great country. We have flaws, but having traveled all over the world, I'm telling you, there's no place you can go that you will not want to get back home. This is the greatest country on the face of the earth, and we are a magnificent, generous, self-sacrificing group of people. We have helped people throughout the world in so many different ways, and we have lost thousands and thousands of lives helping other people. We are a good country. Read your history and realize that someday you might be 82 years old, if you're lucky, like me, and you need to be telling kids the same story I just told you. This is a great country, and you are blessed to be a citizen of the United States of America.
Orson Swindle, thank you so much. This is Kim Munson with the AmeriChicks signing off. So today, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. God bless you, and God bless America.
God bless.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker, commentators, hosts, their guests, and callers. They are not necessarily the views and opinions of Crawford Broadcasting or KLZ Management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.